What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning into the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and I have another hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very talented music producer who has been in the business for over two decades, producing and recording with some of the biggest names in the business. For all you R&B fans out there, you should know one of his best production works, a very popular song titled Somebody Else's Guy, performed by recording artist Joycelyn Brown. Please put your hands together. Welcome music producer and musician, Mr. Alan George. What's happening, Alan?
Hey, what's going on, Spud?
Oh, man. Pleasure, dude, to have you on my show. Truly an honor, yeah. Alan. I love your music. I love your production, man. It's just going to be another hot show for us, man. Thanks for being here,
bro. Thank you. My pleasure.
You know, I got to talk about that track, Somebody Else's Guy, Alan. Till this day, man, I can't run across any radio station. I'm out of Minneapolis, but if I go to Chicago, if I go to LA, if I go to Florida, I still run across that track on the radio, man. It's still a very popular song to play.
Yeah. We did that in 84.
Wow.
Well, I remember when we did that song, there was another version of that song recorded by the Larry Levan, who was one of the premier DJs for dance music in the country, and he was the DJ at the Paradise Garage, a legendary disco in New York. You know, wow. Jocelyn had did a version with him, but she wanted, you know, she didn't really like it. She wanted something more R&B. So when we did the record, we really got along musically because her background was more like she's a commercial singer. She did jingles and she sang with Bette Midler. She had done records with Change. She was a featured vocalist on the Change album with Luther Vandross. If you turn over the B-side of the Change album when Luther sang The Glow of Love, the B-side of the album was Jocelyn Brown. A lot of people don't know that.
Wow.
No, there's a lot of history with Jocelyn. So when we did the record, is my partner Fred McFarlane, who's actually he's a child prodigy. He went to school with Marcus Miller and Poojie Bell, who are great musicians. They all went to school together.
Wow.
So it's like these guys are serious musicians. And you know, when we did the record, it was such a great thing because when we first finished the record, nobody understood this record. Everyone was like, it's too black. We don't know what we could do with this record. It's not a club record, you know, and record companies was like, we don't want this. We think it's just another R&B record. But the only DJ that really told us, man, this record is going to change your life was Frankie Crocker on BLS. The wow. Legendary Frankie Crocker, he played the record one day at 4 o'clock, and I've never seen a switchboard light up so much. It was incredible. I mean, and from that day, the record just took off like wildfire. Every market that record went into, it dominated the market. Like, you had all these great records in the market with Luther, with Michael, everything. When you put that Jocelyn Brown, Somebody Else's Guy in that market, it took over the market. It was just an amazing record. And to this day, it's just one of those records that is bigger than everybody.
Right.
Like, some records are just bigger than the people who made it.
No, totally, man. I totally agree with you, Alan.
And that's one of those records.
Definitely. You know, I got to ask you, man, how and when did you start in the business as a full-time musician or producer? I mean, which came first for you in the business, as a producer or as a musician?
Well, you know, I was years ago, I was a bass player. I started as a bass player. I worked with some of the guys who worked with the Jimmy Castor Bunch, Jerry Brown and Bobby Manigault. His name is Jerry Thomas, who actually played for the Fatback Band. But it was Jerry Thomas, it was Bobby Manigault. We used to do records at Opal Studios, which was owned by, and back in the day, Scepter Records Studio, which had Dionne Warwick and the Isley Brothers and Burt Bacharach and Hal David. They all started at the studio.
Yeah.
And I started playing sessions there, and I started cleaning up the studio. That's how I actually started going into the studio. I took over from the janitor guy who gave me the job, and he never paid me. He was like, if you want to clean up the studio, you got to clean up for free, and maybe they'll give you the job. I just wanted to be in the studio. I didn't care about the money.
Right.
So So I was just fascinated with all the console, everything. I was like, what, 13 or 14 years old? And I went in the studio, and, you know, I watched people like Carmen McCrae record, and I watched all these great Van McCoy guys recording their records, and man, it was just an experience that I'll never forget. And one day, the guy said, man, I need a bass player, and I can't find this guy, so I didn't show up. I said, well, I play the bass. The guy said, you really play the bass? Said, yeah, I play the bass. He said, can you play the bass? Said, I think he can. Well, go home and get your bass. It took me an hour to get back. So I'm going to come back. And that was my first session. And I never looked back since then. I started, you know, writing songs with the guys and producing. And that was my end in the record business.
Wow, that's amazing, man. You always, you know, you think about the times when you first started. It's like, man, what was that first break? And, you know, never seems to amaze me, man. We can just kind of go back and, you know, pull that day out of our head like it just happened yesterday, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, Alan, definitely. I gotta ask you, man, with your experience and background, man, I mean, who was some of your musical influences in your life? You know, whose direction did you adapt into your own musical journey?
Well, you know, I was in love with Larry Graham.
Oh yeah.
I mean, Sly and the Family Stone was like my total inspiration.
Nice.
As musicians, as writers, I just loved their music. And it was the Commodores. I loved the Commodores. I always loved the way Lionel Richie and the Commodores played, and James Carmichael produced. It was just,
yeah,
to me, that was perfection as far as musicianship.
Right.
You know, and I always liked I liked the Beatles.
Oh yeah.
I always liked the way, I was like, John Lennon to me was like one of the most prolific writers that ever existed.
I agree.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, I always grabbed, you know, and of course Motown. I mean, my first record I ever bought was The Marvelettes, My Baby Must Be a Musician. Because I love that little sound effect that went dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, but you see, the thing that was good is that I learned from them how to structure a song.
Right.
And I always said, man, if the song doesn't make sense, I don't know how great the record is. If we can't get the message through the song, it's worthless. I always had that where the song has to come first. No matter how great the music is, if the song is not, if people don't understand what the singer is singing, then we don't have a record.
I agree.
Because in the end of the day, the singer's got to sell this. You know what I mean? So
oh, yeah.
That's why I kind of like, I started getting my, I guess back in those days, we had such people with so much great music that it was easy to get inspiration from it.
You know, it is, man. I think, you know, back in the, even till day, some guys still adapt their old methods of recording, because it does go back to the recording and the song itself, Alan. It does fall back to, you know, the musicians, going back to the piano, you know, going to the lyricism, working sometimes out of the studio, and, you know, just getting that foundation built first and then taking it to the studio and build around it. You know, the timeless songs that I feel are the good songwriters, like Lionel Richie, John Lennon, you know, some of the great ones out there, man, you know, Stevie Wonder. I mean, you can listen to these guys' lyrics and it's never dated. It's timeless material because they focus on the song first and,
right,
you know, just built a production around it. Yeah, I totally agree with you, man.
I never forget when me and Fred produced and wrote a song called Bad Habits for an artist named Jimmy Burton on Atlantic Records.
Wow.
And I never forget, we had a meeting in Quincy Jones's office one time, we were in L.A. And Quincy, you know, when Quincy said, oh, you guys producing all that record? I like that record. Good arrangements. You guys are pretty good. I like that horn sound. And I was like, you know, when someone like Quincy says that to you, you'd be like, wow, Quincy Jones said he liked my record.
Get that stamp of approval.
It's like, no, you know, I walked down the stairs. I forgot what the meeting was about. I didn't care if he ever hired me again in life. This is the fact that Quincy Jones liked my record.
Oh yeah.
That was like, wow. I kept talking about it. And some guy said, what does Quincy like your record? He didn't buy it. It doesn't matter. He said he liked it.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of respect that I had for somebody like Quincy, who, is just probably the best producer in America.
Oh, totally. Quincy Jones is the father of all producers. I don't care.
You know what I mean?
Who so you are, like, man? He started
that stamp
first.
Of approval is like, wow, man. You know, you guys like, you know, and so producing records to me has been is an art. To me, it's an art form.
It is totally. You know, with your background, Alan, man, you have a strong history of recording, you know, coming from the analog background and, you know, moving into the DAW formats of recording. Give me some history of, you know, some of the formats that you started on and what you're currently tracking recording on today, producing your albums.
Well, you know, we started producing records, like we started on a 8-track machine. But when we started making records, I always made records in the 24-track format. Okay. You know, always wanted a 24-track. Then we started using the digital. We were actually, me and Fred was actually one of the beta testers for digital design. Yeah, because I can't remember what it was. They had like a 2-track recording thing that they were at first. Then they came up with it, and then we was doing some mastering on that, and we said we liked it, but it had a little glitches in it. Then we started using the 8-track Tascam stuff.
Okay.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, man, I owned a Tascam Studio 8 track recorder. It had the built-in reel-to-reel. That was my first analog recording. So, yeah, man, I love Tascam gear.
the 8-track digital was the first one. We got off of analog because, see, we used to, when you know, we got off of analog. Well, I guess we always stayed in analog because I really liked the sound of analog.
Right.
And I don't think digital has really come to the analog sound yet.
No, you know, it's the circuitry, you know, out of the
analog has a certain warmth to it that to me it just can't be reduced. The way the heads go across the magnets of the tape is like that warmth is just hard to reproduce. It's noisy,
right?
But at the same time, I think a lot of records sounded better with noise.
Oh yeah, you gotta have it, man. You know, plus the headroom was higher.
It's
yeah.
Like, it's like the bottom of the bottom of your record. Like, how many times do you hear a record when the horns are blowing? It's like being live. Like, you don't hear the hits in the speakers if the whole band's playing.
No, I totally agree with you, man. Yeah.
So people get twisted. Now, digital is the new digital stuff coming out now with the Pro Tools 10 and the Logic. It's really close to what we want to be at because it's quiet and it has a little warmth to it, and I don't like that glass slick that digital sound. I hate that. And in order for the some of the engines to translate better, I think it needs that dark warmth in it.
It does. And granted, a lot of the converters that we have now are a lot better than they were 10 years ago.
Right.
But still, to get that good color into our signal chain. You know, I tell a lot of guys, like, man, we got to warm up that signal. You got to use some good mic pre's going into your digital interface. I mean, that's the only way they're going to try to capture some essence of analog into your recording. You know, run that mic pre and pretty much everything that you're running in. I mean, just running into your inputs of your sound card, it helps. But again, you know, a $400 sound card is not going to compete against something like a Rosetta 800 series or maybe your Pro HD rig interfaces. So it's like, man, we want to get as good of a clean signal as possible. So having that good mic preamp is always kind of like the first stepping stone into a good recording signal.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still trying to. I'm actually in the process of negotiating for a Neve console that came out of Capitol's recording studio.
Wow, good old Neve.
I want that board, man. I'm really a big Neve fan.
You know, man, it's just the two of the Titans, man, the SSL and the Neves. I mean, everyone can go back and forth on, you know, their favorite console, but I think it's really a matter of preference and taste. I mean, those are just two top-of-the-line consoles that guys like you and other seasoned musician veterans are still going after to have in their own personal studio.
Yeah, because, see, that's the thing. See, the digital chip made it possible for a lot of us to make home recording studios.
Mm-hmm.
And it really put the major studios out of business because you can get a good sound with at home if you know how to use it. The problem is most musicians aren't engineers.
Right, right.
And they come in with these crappy sounding records. That's the problem.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of cats that make records, like sometimes when you hear these rap records, well, you know, some of them you don't really need good recording to make them anyway.
Right.
Quincy, Bruce Sweden didn't have to work on this rap record.
Right. You know, it's a lot of these guys, you know, it's kind of an unfair advantage because a lot of these guys are using samples that are already mixed, you know,
exactly.
so it's like, man, you're using bits and pieces of material that's already been mastered and mixed, you know, then you're going to throw your drum machine over it. Yeah, you're going to have a quicker mix, faster to
and
someone.
Now,
yeah.
And now, when they sample it, it's such a high resolution.
Right.
So it really sounds good because it's like before they used to use the Akai samplers and all that stuff, and those stuff was like, you know,
right,
like 8-bit and 5-bit.
Like SP-1200,
yeah. Now you're talking about a sample at a 64-bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't need that sample at better than that. You don't need 96K to take a James Brown sample.
No, you don't. No, it's going to pound. Yeah, it's going to
so
sound great anyway.
Today are made sound a lot better with the sampling, but to me, the content is terrible. So what's the difference?
Oh, yeah. Man, I'm right there with you.
You got a good sound rap record, but now that content's terrible, so.
Right. Sonically is great, man. It's just not there melodically, I guess.
But me and Fred was always a stickler about great sonic sounding records.
Right.
And we worked with really great engineers.
That helps, man. I mean, with your recording background, are you the type of producer who likes to be hands-on, or do you have your own personal engineer that you allow to mix on your albums and things?
Well, you know, I totally believe in having an engineer in the studio with me. But I'm really doing vocals, and I'm doing vocals, I believe in having an engineer. Because sometimes I don't want the technical part to get in the way of the creative.
Right.
Because a lot of times when I'm doing vocals or when I'm doing instruments, I'm really listening to the person who's doing the recording or the singer or the musician, and I'm trying to lock myself into them with the record, and I don't have time to push buttons and to realize, hey, this is too hot, this is too cold. I got to let somebody else worry about that.
Sure.
Now, after I get it on tape, that's another story.
Right.
But you know what I'm saying? But to get, I think that's what's really missing today. A lot of cats are trying to do three jobs.
Right.
But yes, I always worked with engineers and, you know, and I've taken my engineers with me to Europe to work on records.
Wow.
I mean, I guess that's the kind of culture that we come from, because back in the day, you know, most of the big guys had their own engineers.
Right. I mean, that's just the way to drive anyways. Mm-hmm. You know, things have changed.
Yeah, things have changed.
Right. You know, I speak from experience, too. You know, I'm a keyboardist composer. You know, naturally I'm already hands-on with MIDI and mixing and tracking and just running my own sessions. I've just been really a hands-on person behind the wheel of the vehicle when mixing and engineering, you know, dropping vocals. But it would be really nice, man, just to have that personal engineer on the side where I can focus with the artist and, you know, have them punch in and out and do my edits and run the session along with me. It does help. And traditionally that's the perfect way to run a session. You get done faster, you know, you develop a team behind you, and you guys just really get a chance to, you know, mesh your ears together, and he starts to know what you want sonically out of the track and kind of works ahead of you and kind of thinking ahead of you. Yeah, it's a great partnership to have, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, during the later years, like in the 90s, we wrote and produced Show Me Love with Robinette.
Mm.
And that record was like probably bigger than some of those guys.
Yeah, that was a hot. That was a big album too, man. You've had them out there, Alan.
That record was still. I mean, that record is still. I mean, everywhere in the world you go, you hear this record.
Right.
And like when we recorded that record, I was the engineer on that record because we had recorded her and she did one take on that record. And the take was just so good.
Yeah.
It was such a personal take. I said, you know what, I think I have something to build on. And I think a lot of times we let our production get in the way of getting a good track.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As a producer, I always look for the record to translate through the speakers into something personal. And then I think I got something.
Right.
Someone's got to listen to it and says, wow, I like it. I don't agree with her, but I like what she's saying. Or I like what she's saying, but what, you know, at least you understand what the singer is doing. Yeah. And, you know, I think we were one of the first producers to really get involved in European dance music. See, we did that in the early 90s. And at that point, you had people like Hathaway and Two in the Room and the I think it was Smash or some Snap. Yeah, Snap had some records out there. And we wanted to get involved in the European dance music because we really liked that scene. And we did Robinette and Champion Records put it out, and we hadn't looked back since.
Wow.
It's like an anthem in London and Europe. Like,
I can see that. Yeah, it's a big record, man. You know, just the whole movement.
I mean? Yeah. And Jason Derulo just did it over on his new record, I Don't Want to Go Home, and made it even bigger.
That's how the legacy carries on, though. I mean, you start a whole new trend, a whole new movement, and look how big the dance scene in Europe is now. Guys like you laying that foundations for up-and-coming musicians and producers and vocalists, you know, to see that map, man, and, you know, follow that journey on their own agenda, things that their own personal musical journey. That's just the only way we can grow, you know, and that's what's happening.
Yeah, you know, it's like another record that we did was Madonna's Vogue.
Wow.
Now, that record came about was my partner, Fred McFarlane, and Chef Pettibone, who's a remixer. They were doing all these remixes. They did Janet Jackson, they did Depeche Mode, they did Sia Garrett. I mean, I can't help with John. I mean, you name it, these guys done the remixes.
Wow.
But they had done a lot of mixing for Madonna, and she said, okay, I'm doing the Dick Tracy soundtrack, and I need to get one more record to fill up the album, so I guess we'll let you guys produce it since you guys do all the remixes, and we'll throw you a bone. So Fred does all the keyboards, he writes it with Shep, and Alan last night, he did all the drum programming for it with Fred, and Fred did all the keyboards and arrangements.
Yeah.
And when Madonna sang the vocals, when she heard it, she's like, whoa, this record is hot. I got to put this record out now. So she calls her boy Craig at Maverick, and she goes, we're going to do the video in 2 days. I've never seen a record recorded, video in 3 days, and put on the market in a week.
Wow.
That's power. That's power for someone to have.
That's Madonna,
you know,
man.
And that was Madonna. And Vogue sold, like, what, 3.5 million records? I think that was her biggest selling single.
Yeah, at least.
I mean, and when you talk about the history of making records, man, we could, you know, there's so much that people have to know and understand. And it's like, we have to get it out there. But, yeah, we've been involved in a lot of records.
I can see, man. Your resume is a show in itself, Alan. You know, it's like guys are, man, seriously, guys like you that have so much experience and so many albums, like, man, I try to get, you know, so many questions out. I mean, I can keep you here for 2-4 hours. I mean, we could just chop it up. just that experience, you know. But I'm going to piggyback, and I got to ask you, man, because of the business, you know, promoting yourself as a musician and artist has changed within the past 10 years. With your experience of knowing the business, really knowing the effective way of promoting yourself or an artist or your brand, what some of the steps have you maintained in your own personal marketing strategy?
Well, you see, I always come from a thing where producers is always in the background.
Yeah.
During the time of maybe the mid-80s and the 90s, that the producers stepped up with like Jammin' Lewis and guys like that, and who came out from the background and really started being up front as producers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so I mean, I wasn't really into promoting myself as above the artist.
Right.
That you produce. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I always felt like the production thing was a community. Like, I came up with the Sheath. and a lot of those type of guys, and Paul Lawrence, and so it's always been a community of producers together. And if you cross over as an artist, that's one thing. I never crossed over as an artist. I always stayed as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different when you say promotion. I mean, I always say to myself, listen, you're only as hot as that 350 record you got on the turntable.
That's right.
And when you think you're not, you're fooling yourself.
Yeah.
I always kept that in mind. So, you know, when you're hot, people are going to look for you. The problem today is that these people will call themselves producers because they can play with a computer.
Right.
A lot of times you have producers who, like to me, producing is an experience that you have to go through. You have to understand singing. You have to understand the relationship with the musician and the singer. You have to have the relationship to understand what tape does to a record. Right. All this stuff you learn during the time of as a producer, and you start to understand how sonically you want your stuff to sound, and how you want to get the lyrics to relate to the guitar player, how you want the guitar player to come. All that stuff is about production. And, you know, when you turn on a computer, I don't see how you get all that in one day.
No, you don't. I mean, I think that's where a lot of guys
I remember when Teddy Riley first started.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Teddy came out of Harlem, and one of the first guys that he worked with was me and Fred.
Wow.
Teddy was actually Fred's protege.
Wow.
Because when Fred was actually supposed to do the Keith Sweat album, the first album, which he did, Something Ain't Right, and a couple other tunes he did with Keith, but he couldn't work with Keith. Him and Keith just, you know, they were friends and they couldn't get along.
Right.
But Keith is he's the type of guy who will do a record for 10 hours, and then after he finished the record, you'll say, I don't like that record. And then he'll go back and do another record for 10 hours. And then after 11 hours, he'll go back and say, you know what, I think the first one we did was better. And he would drive them crazy. So that's how Teddy got on the Keith Sweat album, because he said, Teddy, why don't you go and work with Keith Sweat?
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, he played on a couple of our records in when he was younger. It's funny because when Teddy came to the office with this EMU drum machine, when they first put out the EMU drum machine,
mm-hmm.
I was always amazed that Teddy could program this drum machine. I mean, yeah. I was like, Teddy, I watched him in the studio. I'm like, you really know this instrument, don't you? I mean, he was so phenomenal with those machines.
Yeah.
I mean, I was knocked out by it. I remember telling Fred, because Fred was on the road with D-Train at the time.
Okay.
And he came off the road, and we were producing, I think, Jenny Burton and some other tracks we were doing, and I had used Teddy to do some of the stuff. And I played it for Fred. I said, Fred, do you like this EMU drum machine? And he said, yeah, I heard it. He said, man, you got to hear Teddy program this damn machine. He said, oh, man, the kids know about that. They play those Atari games all day. Of course they're going to be great at those drum machines. So, I mean, it's like, and it's a good thing, because what happens is the New Jack Swing is actually someone else's guy. Is like, you know, is where it all really started, because the someone else's guy record was a combination of go-go music and swing.
That's right.
That's what it was.
Oh, yeah.
Because Fred's by trade. No, Fred's father actually played with Lionel Hampton. He was a bass player.
Oh, wow.
So Fred comes from a jazz background.
Man.
So he's a great jazz musician.
Wow.
So when we did Somebody Else's Guy, we knew that Larry Lazanne had done a version. And we were on tour with D-Train at the time, and we used to always run into Washington with Trouble Funk and Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers. And man, we heard that go-go sound, and it just floored us.
Wow.
I mean, so we put some of that in the music.
Oh, yeah, you can definitely hear it, though.
And that's what I think is missing today. Producers don't do that.
But you know what, though, Alan? To do that, and I stress this all the time on my show to everybody, is that, man, if you really want to excel, you're going to have to learn how to play some instruments. I'm sorry. I mean, you can chop up and sample all day long, but you're missing a lot of the foundation and a lot of the emotions, I mean, because that's coming from live instrumentation. These are guys who, you know, coming in with their keyboards, coming with their bass guitars, their guitars, their drums, live musicians, man, really putting it down the way it should be done. And, you know, yeah, you could replicate and sample it, but it's going to sound mechanical, I promise you. There's no improv. You can't improv. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember when I remember when we were on tour with D-Train, and the first time we heard, we were opened up for the Bar Cave, and when I heard the Bar Cave live, because I've always heard the Bar Cave on record, I've always, you know, I've been a big fan. But when I stepped, when I was on backstage, I heard the Bar Cave. You talking about a lesson in funk?
Oh yeah.
You want to talk about some funk? The Bar Cave. The Bar Cave was so good, I couldn't believe it. I was like, what the hell?
Oh, yeah.
They just totally, that just sitting there for 40 minutes and listening to the Bar Cave was an education. And I think that a lot of groups, what's happening is that they don't, that's the problem with music today. We don't have that type of situation going on where the young musicians learn from the older musicians. And we interact with each other with music, and we share our experience, musical experiences, and we pass it, and we go into the next, you know, we draw from that to go take it somewhere else.
Right.
And that's why a lot of music is just standing still, because there's no one out there to take it to the next level.
Right.
Everybody's stopped on one thing. You know, it's like, I didn't get in this, I really got in this music to exchange experiences and to make great music. I mean, coming to this music to sell 2.5 million records and that's it.
Right. Well, that's what it is,
that's
man.
The
it's the money.
Of you taking great records.
It's the money. They see the money. They see the videos, the cars. I mean, gosh, I was like, man, that's cool. But when I was coming up 14, 15, it was just a different era. It was about, you know, how cold are you as a keyboardist, man? I mean, your runs, your chord progressions. I mean, musically, where's your mind at? You know, I mean, that's where it was at. But nowadays, like, man, how many units, how many tracks have you sold? And how many Yorkers have you sold? And who have you produced? And yeah, it becomes a business, which is cool, and I can understand. But the musicianship, is getting lost. And I totally agree with you.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think until we get back to that in some way, and also radio has kind of destroyed the foundations of music, because when you look back at radio, it used to be a thing where New York, I remember I used to come to New York, I would hear a certain type of music, I'd go to Philly and hear a certain type of music, then I'd go down south, South Carolina, I heard a certain type of music, then when I went to LA, I heard a whole nother type of music.
Yeah.
So every state or every region had its identity.
Totally.
Today, you hear Beyonce from LA to New York, and it's one format.
Right.
So it killed the musical growth of people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Alan. Totally.
It's not to say that it's Beyonce, but I'm just using her as a format where you would hear a Mary J. record or a Beyonce record in every state in rotation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great for the publishers.
Right, right.
But it doesn't serve the industry.
No, I
agree. And in the end, it starts to kill the industry. So this like the industry is suffering from a multiple daggers in it. Now it's so many daggers that they don't know which one to take out first.
Right. No, I hear you, Alan. You know, I'm a huge fan of playing remakes as a keyboardist and, you know, reproducing some of my favorite tracks, you know, from back in the day. Are there any tracks out there, man, that you haven't had a chance to reproduce for an artist, you know, to give it that Alan George stamp that you like to tackle?
You know, that's a great question. And I always wanted to do A Woman's Got to Have It by Bobby Womack.
Okay, yeah.
I wanted to produce that for Robinette. I never got a chance to.
Wow.
But that's a record. And I always wanted to do Trust Maker, You Little Trust Maker. I wanted to do that track, and I wanted Larry Graham to play on it. You know, it's funny because I went to one of my one of the people I worked with for years was Shelby Johnson. And she's actually one of the lead singers for Prince's band.
Wow.
And she's been with Prince for like 5 or 6 years now.
Wow.
And she recently had got married in North Carolina, and the Prince and all the band was down there. And I actually sat next to Larry Graham at the wedding.
Nice.
I sat next to Larry for about 3 or 4 hours. Like, how do you like to sit next to your idol for that long?
Larry's cool, man. I had a chance to interview Larry last year.
I heard it.
Yeah, man.
He's a great person.
He is, man. Real cool guy. Another industry veteran. Just a monster on the bass, man. Till this day, you could just watch Larry just like, oh, man, that's not even right how cold you are, man.
But you see, the thing about it is that Larry's a very modest person.
Oh, big time. Oh, yeah.
And I got that being next to him. He is a very modest person.
Very.
The way he carries himself, he's a man of God. The way he carries himself, when he talks, it's not an act with Larry Graham. That's Larry Graham.
Right.
And his influence on Sly and the Family Stone is, it wouldn't be a Sly and the Family Stone if Larry Graham didn't play bass.
No. No way. That was the meat and potatoes of the band, man.
Yeah. And so, when you talk about a bass playing the influence of somebody musical and doing a record over, I mean, Larry Graham is like, wow. It's like it's a lot of songs. Like, that's what I really miss is songs. Now that you said that, songs are so important.
It is. It is. It really
songs
is.
Songs are so important. And I like music that comes from, I never forget, you just remind me of a situation. I was in a studio one time with my friend who owned one of the old Hit Factory studios, that Record Plant in the day? And Mick Jagger was in the studio.
Wow.
And I took a picture with Mick Jagger, we were talking, and I asked Mick Jagger, I said, what kind of records do you influence? Because I told him that I produced somebody else's guy. He said, he was like, a light came on in his face. He said, wow, you did it? Man, I love that record.
Wow.
He said, man, that record had some soul in it. That's a record. And I said, what kind of stuff do you listen to, Mick? He said, man, I listen to the Holland Whoops, the blues, the Delta stuff. That's me. That's all I listen to. That's my influence.
Yeah.
And it's just strange how I tell people, when you listen to somebody like Janet Joplin sing, you can't say white people don't got soul.
No, you can't, man. It's wherever you your know, ears
it's like,
are.
It's,
yeah.
I say, listen, it's a thing where once the music is in the air, it belongs to everybody.
Oh, totally. Music is it's a musical culture, man. We got our own culture.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? If you're around somebody who listens to funk every single day, I don't care what race you are, man, he's just going to be a funky individual. I mean, that's true. Yeah, I mean, that's what he's brought up in. That's in him, you know? That is who he is.
And when you hear, Janet Joplin do Tell Mama by the late Etta James.
Oui.
When she does Tell Mama, it just floors me. Because she takes it to a whole other world.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, she takes it to a whole nother level.
Right. Right. And if you're a good appreciator for music, you're going to appreciate Janis Joplin. You just will. She's just a great artist. I mean, you can't take that from
exactly.
her.
Exactly. And her vocal ability just floors me.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's like, yeah. It's so many influences in this thing.
You know, we just now hit 2012, Alan, man. What's on the musical agenda for you for this year?
You know, I'm working on a group. Me and Fred, we don't. Fred is doing 1,001 things. I'm doing 1,001 things. And we finally decided we're putting a group together because we got a great bunch of musicians and we want to record something different. And we have a group called The Last Soul Band, and we're gonna try to do an album. And we're going to put it out. So hopefully we'll get it done this year. And because we already did like 3 tracks. And it feels good to be in the studio with musicians and playing and producing. And it feels good to do that. So yeah. I got a couple other artists I'm doing, but I'm like you say, we're working at it. We're working at it. We're going to see what happens. But we've been like writing songs. It's just a matter of us getting back on that horse and doing what we got to do.
That's right. Well, Alan, it's been a pleasure having you on my show, man. Truly an honor. I would love to have you back, man. Talk about your new band that you're putting together. Any kind of production works that you're doing on the side, man. You definitely got a spot here at the Producers Corner, Alan.
Oh, thank you, Spud. It's great to be talking to you, man. I just want to spread the word and spread the love and try to see if we can put it all back together for all of us.
Oh, yeah, it's going to come, man. It's going to happen. We'll get it popping. Yeah. Well, you have a safe 2012, man. We'll keep in touch, man.
Okay.
All right. Have a safe one, bro.
You got it, baby.
All right. Peace. And a big shout out to Alan George for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. Always a pleasure to talk to a legend like Alan George, man. He has a lot of experience in production, extensive experience as a recording engineer. And he's an excellent bass player. And just to have that opportunity and that one-on-one time with him, man, it's truly inspirational. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit me up at www.spudtootight.com. www.spudtootight.com. And I want to thank everybody for tuning and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.